Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. Thanks so much for downloading us, however you consume the Baseball America podcast, and we hope you consume it on the way to a Thanksgiving of football and turkey and all that good stuff. Some of us are hitting the road sooner than later, so we're recording the podcast on the morning on Tuesday. And I want to remind you that the 2012 Baseball America reference books are going to be available soon. We've finished one of them. The Almanac is done. Coming back with the proof stage, I got to add in my Japan lead, JJ. And so the 2012 Almanac off the press, Prospect Handbook soon to be completed, the directory, the draft almanac's already done, the Super Register, the bane of Matt Eddy's existence will be done soon. So all the Baseball America books are available. You can order them early, make a great gift. And they're available at baseballamerica.com/store. And again, really the showcase book for that, JJ, is our Prospect Handbook. So we're going to talk National League Central Top 10 Prospects. Obviously, they go to 30. But let's talk real quick about it's award season. It's not Wabbit season. It's not Duck season.
It's book season for us. It's award season for baseball in general.
It is. And today we'll have the National League MVP award
which
announced.
Which might get overshadowed today a little bit.
Yeah. We have the today. Also, later today, we'll probably record a podcast either tomorrow or first of next week on the big news of the day, which is the CBA announcement that'll come up this afternoon. Very excited. Let's quickly touch on that, JJ. Just the fact that the NBA is in this, what David Stern even called a nuclear winter. The NFL had a difficult lockout. Obviously, they came through that pretty well as a sport, but you did have a lot of hoo-ha about OHGH testing, and then, oh, not really. It really doesn't seem like there was a lot of did the NFL make steps forward in its lockout? Did they come through the lockout in better shape, you think, than they did before? Probably the owners, I guess, did.
The owners really did, didn't. I think. You know, the owners did, and I think I don't think the players would say necessarily. And
the thing are the players any safer than they were before? Were there any safety things?
Yeah, they put in some rules on, like, concussions is a mandatory, you cannot return to the game. Before, it was kind of, you know, doctor's discretion and, hey, right. If the team doctor gets paid by the team, I think he's okay. He can. That's a stinger, you know. But yeah, so those kind of things. But
if
but
you're a
no.
young player listening to this, just listen to that part. If you play football and baseball, if you want to think in 20 years or you want to be alive past 50, play baseball.
But nothing like this labor agreement in baseball where – you do. It's amazing to say that they've seems like everyone somewhat got it at this point that it's better for everyone to have a partnership of sorts than it is to have World War 72.
It's amazing that the NBA really is kind of where the baseball as a sport was in 1994, in that it has absolutely no trust between the two sides. There are a lot of ways that it's different from 1994, I'm not trying to make a 100% analogy, but the thing that's very that is directly analogous is the players completely don't trust the owners. They don't trust the owners' numbers. They don't trust the owners' motives. Anything the owners say, they can't be compromised when you don't even think the other side is being legitimate or upfront with you.
And this is where I'll say that Major League Baseball's Players Association has one of their core stances. Whatever you think of a salary cap, you don't have to trust the owners nearly as much if you don't have a salary cap. You may not believe their numbers. That's fine. Because what you're saying is hey, I'm not fixed. Baseball is not set where they get a fixed amount of revenue.
Right. Yeah, good point.
And if you have a fixed amount of revenue, then you have to have some trust of the other side.
What that revenue is.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing that baseball has avoided of all the sports. And again, you may be, you know, I know we probably have listeners who think that a salary cap would make things better. At the same time, one of the side effects that I don't think a whole lot of people think of is that in baseball, the Players Association can say, you know what? Whether we believe you're bringing in $3.5 billion or $2 billion or whatever that
or
number
$7
is,
billion.
Or $7 billion, which is what, whatever that number is. That is not as important to us because our structure is set up that if one team's willing to pay you, that's fine because there's taxes and all. But if the Yankees want to pay a guy $25 million,
right?
They can pay – if they want to pay 10 guys $25 million, they can.
They can, and it doesn't really – no one has to know how much money the Yankees are bringing in because as long as their checks don't bounce, basically,
right.
They can pay what they want to. And, JJ, that's also been what has been true in the draft. It appears that the most significant change in the CBA for our listeners, we don't have the specifics of this yet, but it's going to be some kind of luxury tax, it sounds like, on the draft. My basic point on this, without knowing the details, and we don't want to talk too long about this, I think that Jim Callis and I will podcast on this either later in the week or first of next week. But to me, every attempt that the owners have made to put a drag on salaries on signing bonuses has essentially failed. The draft worked for the first 20 years. Ken Griffey Jr. got less money as a first overall pick in 1987 than Rick Reichert got.
First number one pick.
And everyone knew. Than Rick Reichert got as the top draft pick, not draft pick, but the top free agent in 1964. So that just tells you how well the draft worked for the first 20, 25 years of
for
its
the
existence.
Owners.
But once the, yeah. Oh, yeah,
not
absolutely.
For the players, but for the owners, yeah.
But once the money in the game was so much smaller, but still, it would have worked a lot
once
better
Todd
for the
Van
owner.
Poppel.
But once, yeah, basically, once agents got into it, and Scott Boras Corporation, Scott Boras, first of all, by himself, really changed things with guys like Tim Belcher and Curt Stillwell and then Ben McDonald. That's really what changed the draft. And since then, bonuses have skyrocketed, and it's been incremental increases and then sometimes bigger increases. And I think there's always a law of unintended consequences. Everything they try to do to keep bonuses down, the agents and the players and the clubs find loopholes because the clubs want players, period. They want players. They want talent. And so I still don't think it's going to have a giant chilling effect on baseball's ability to acquire talent. But it might, in the first year or two, I think you will probably see some bonuses go down. And Ben Ballard's very, I think, he's reporting there's a lot of very unsettled people in Latin America who think that if you put a cap on international signings, then all that's going to mean is bigger kickbacks and less money to the players who actually deserve the money.
And the other thing with this is that, and again, we'll have to see, first of all, what the structure is, and then see what the unintended effects, because as you said, it always happens that whatever Major League Baseball has tried to do in the last 10 years especially has never really worked out exactly as they think it will. But, I mean, one of the things I've not heard lately is what the signing date's going to be, which I'll be very interested to hear what the – because there seems
correct.
To be – that's one thing that seems to – there's a consensus on, which is –
I think we really do think it's going to be July 15th.
Which would be – I think – I don't think you hear anyone who will disagree with that.
I think that I agree with you.
And you know what? If I'm the New York Penn League or I'm the Northwest League, I'm ecstatic when I hear that.
Oh, absolutely. I think the best thing actually might be, JJ, if they move the draft further back in June and move the signing date up. They can move the draft unilaterally anytime in the month of June. So if they had the draft at basically the end of June and then the signing deadline was basically the week after the All-Star game, why is that bad? That would be awesome. You have 2 weeks.
You've had scouting directors tell you too, but I've had scouting directors tell me, we can do this in a couple of days.
Correct.
I mean, really, it's...
Hey, if you love the draft, you have to either have read or you should read... Alex Speer, our Red Sox correspondent at WEEI.com, did an amazing feature a couple weeks after the fact on the Red Sox deadline on August 16th this year and how they handled the deadline, how they had a dozen computers set up. All of them have like the email of these rough drafts of the contract ready to go. Just their level of preparation that they did to handle negotiations, like 6, 7, 8 negotiations at the last minute.
And the reality of it is that they did all of those, and if you moved it up to July 15th, they'd have done the same thing.
Exactly,
it would not have
right.
changed it at all. There's not one of those that they said, we're not ready to do this negotiation.
Correct. So I agree with you. Good that you brought that up. The deadline hopefully will move up and I think should move up and won't be a big difference.
The other thing that I'll say that could, if this works as MLB says that they hope it will, I actually think the teams that will be hurt by it are some of the small market teams.
I agree to an extent, yes. Again, without knowing the specifics, I don't know
right.
if we can
right. I don't want to go into
it, but
100%. I'm just saying, if it works as MLB hopes, if MLB, because MLB's intention with this is that we're not going to see, they want to keep bonuses down and to not see outliers.
Right.
They want
less Mark Binfords.
Right. They
He's
want
a Royals prospect that you're
But they
writing.
Want
Is
they
it Christian
want,
Binford or Mark?
Christian, I think, yeah. But they want I'm right now so much in Royals that it's not Jack Lopez.
It's Binford.
Yeah, but there are – they don't want you to see, something where, okay, well, that guy was a first-round talent and he fell to the fourth round. That's one of the things that they seem to – their goal, whether it happens or not, but that's their goal. Their goal is that
– what they think they're doing by putting in these kind of things, that the first pick in the draft will be the team that – they'll be the player that team thought was number one on its board. The second pick in the draft will be the team that guy thought was number two. And then the 62nd pick in the draft will not be the guy who will sign at the 62nd slot. It's the guy that team wanted. That's their goal. Their goal is to have it set up so teams know what it costs to sign the player. The teams know what it costs to sign. The players know what bonus they'll get. And you take the player and he signs and there's no rancor, basically. That's their utopian vision of the draft.
Which is
everyone gets the players they want. That's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. I don't know why they keep trying to have that as their utopian vision.
And this is the thing that Jim Callis has said. And we can wrap it up with this if we want to move on to it. But, again, not knowing specifics, but Jim Callis has made the point 1,000 times. And I've kind of, I agree with him on this. I think you do, too. If you are working on trying to keep these bonuses down and you're doing that, what you're doing, if you're a small market team, the best money you can spend as a small market team is – if you spend an extra $6 million in your draft,
yep,
the potential bang for your buck on that $6 million, which if you spend an extra $6 million in a draft, that's taking you a lot of times from, say, spending 6 to 12. That's significant.
I agree.
That is way better for you as an organization
than spending Cliff Barmas for $10 million.
Right, which is what the Pirates just did. And the reality of it is that money is – not nearly as useful as when they spent, what was it, $14 million or whatever?
Yeah,
when they signed Bell and Cole. And
$13 million on Cole and Bell alone. And I like Clint Barmas as a nice stopgap big league shortstop. But yes,
but if you're
for the long term health of the organization, it's better to spend that money.
And if your intent as Major League Baseball is, if there is any way, and I don't think it is, but if their intent is that they want competitive balance.
This, I think they do want that, actually.
I think they do. I don't think that anything they're doing with the draft here is actually about competitive balance. I think it's about limiting bonuses.
Correct. I agree. Originally, I think that the history of the draft is that it has led to competitive balance.
Right. I'm not saying that it's better than a free-for-all. Yes, the draft.
I think that was the original intention
right.
in some ways, but the other thing was, yes.
But the reality of it is that if they're saying saving you're looking money. At it and saying the Red Sox and Yankees spend a lot of money, especially the Red Sox spend a lot of money in the draft, that's true. But you know what? They don't spend all that much more than the Pirates.
The gap between them and the draft and other teams is a lot smaller in the draft than it is in the Major
right.
League salary.
Right.
So we'll talk more about the draft and its ramifications and the changes in the CBA on another podcast. Real quick, before we get to the NL Central, we also need to talk about this award thing that we were arguing about before. Well, we won't even have to have that same argument. Justin Verlander, American League MVP, you're okay with that?
Mm.
I was okay with that, even though I don't think if you're looking through the history of pitcher seasons, is Justin Verlander more deserving than Pedro Martinez was in 1999 or 2000?
No.
Certainly he's not.
No.
But the offensive numbers are down in 2011. There really wasn't a standout position player, I don't think, JJ. I mean,
the guy who's a standout position player, a lot of guys aren't going to vote for.
Well, there were two, actually. Jose Bautista's offensive numbers are slightly better than Jacoby Ellsbury's, but not by a ton.
Right,
and Jacoby Ellsbury plays center field and plays it well. I don't think it was a slam dunk that Bautista had the best season.
I think Bautista probably did, but it wasn't.
I don't. I think by some WAR measurements, if you want to use WAR, Ellsbury was number one
right.
in WAR.
Personally, I think Bautista probably had the best season, but I think both of those, right. Both. The reality, though, is that there are a lot of voters out there who are not going to – and, again – I'm not someone who subscribes to theory, especially when it comes to a case like if you're telling
right.
me that Ellsbury is valuable if they win in game 162 and he's not valuable enough if they lose in game 162,
right.
that makes no sense to me at all. I'm sorry, but the logic that, it doesn't matter because they didn't make the playoffs, to me, I understand value. You can work it a million different ways, but especially that argument to me makes no sense at all. Well, I'm sorry they didn't make the playoffs, therefore he can't be MVP.
I think it has a small amount of value. I don't dismiss that at all.
But
I don't think that. But I your point that Boston makes the playoff, that one game difference, that's a good point.
That one inning. That, you know, they basically.
That's a good point. If you thought that Jacoby Ellsbury was the MVP on game 159 when the Red Sox had a two-game lead and you thought they were going to make the playoffs, then you thought he was, but they didn't win it. Because, you know, it's not like he did anything bad.
Right.
Last
like, again, he did everything he could. He did everything he could those last couple games. I don't understand that logic.
But I do think there's logic in voting for a player if they're similar seasons.
Oh, yeah.
I got in a first or second place. And that's my – so that my so my point is that I would have voted for Ellsbury over Batista because they had very similar seasons.
And again, there's a logic to that. I could understand that.
And Ellsbury kind of did everything he could to put that team on his back. But I love looking at the BREF WAR, by the way. I never looked at Baseball References WAR. The year-by-year leaders, that Albert Pujols has led the National League.
Yeah.
It had been six straight years until this year with Matt Kemp. Matt Kemp was the first 10 WAR season since Barry Bonds. Matt Kemp was R, not because of his WAR. I'm just looking at his WAR. But he was R Major League Player of the Year.
We did mention it. I mean,
but that, well, yeah, that's not why I voted for him. But it did come up. I didn't know that he had. I knew that he had an historic or ahistoric. I prefer ahistoric. Anyway, he had a historic season for center fielder. He was kind of an easy choice for us actually for Major League Player of the Year.
Do you think he'll
win the National League MVP?
I think it's about 50-50.
Yeah, I think more likely Ryan Braun's going to win that.
Right.
I really do think Ryan Braun's going to win
that. You know, that's...
It's defensible.
It's defensible.
You don't seem to think so, actually.
No, I do think it's defensible. I do. Again, I have a different approach as far as my logic of it, but I understand that
have,
is...
Neither of us have votes, by the way. None of us at Baseball America have a vote.
Right.
Or has a vote.
But I understand that there's a logic to that as well. You have different... I mean, to sound all snooty about, there's different paradigms, and I have mine,
paradigm,
and some people
nice.
Have others, you know, and that's fine. I think there are different defensible choices.
To me, Braun and Kemp had very similar seasons. I don't see giving it to a left fielder over a center fielder. And even with the Brewers season, to me, Prince Fielder's season is so similar to Ryan Braun's. To me, Ellsbury was clearly the Red Sox best player. It was head and shoulders above Dustin Pedroia and Adrian Gonzalez, as good as those guys were. I don't think you can make that same case for Ryan Braun. And defensively, he and Prince Fielder play positions that are basically of equal importance. They're low on the – their job is to hit. Their best position is batter's box. Ryan Braun should be better on defense, but he's not. So to me, that's a knock against him. That's why I would vote for Kemp. Plus, the Dodgers did have a winning record. They weren't really contenders, but they were quite good in the second half. And on a team with all that turmoil, they're a little bit of a special case in that it was so ugly there and that Kemp rose above that – difficulty, I give him some points for that.
Right. That's where, to me, like it is easier to me to vote from the standpoint of, okay, I'm not saying you don't get a couple of bonus points if your team was a championship team or was, you know, made a wild
card. It's certainly easier.
It's a bonus point.
It's certainly easier.
But it makes it a little easier to be consistent, though, if you say, look, if you say, because the reality is this, and this is what they want, when they say, choose the most valuable player. By design, they don't come out and say, here is what.
They don't make it simple.
They say, give your opinion of value.
They being the BBWAA.
Right. They give your opinion of value. And you can view value differently than someone else.
I don't mind it being a little complicated for some people.
I don't have a problem with that in that just because I view it this way doesn't mean my way is right. It's
right.
But I do try to, if you said, what would I do, try to be consistent on it from...
It is analogous, though, to how we rank prospects. You rank prospects a little differently than I might rank them, a little bit differently than Jim Callis might rank them. We're not monolithic, and I don't see that as a problem. Some people
do. But now
do.
I'll say this. But as a BA, when you see our top 10, the writer who puts it together is our starting point on that.
Correct.
At the same time,
and the National League Central, by the way, we have a lot of out-of-house writers.
At the same time, though, the best way to put it is I don't know if anyone ever puts together a top 30 and we don't at least debate moving guys around in it.
There is not a top 30 in the book that guys will get moved around on, including Jim's. Right. I move guys around on Jim's lists.
Because it is still the Baseball America ranking, and as such, I think of one of the strengths of it is that it is a list that starts out at one thing, and then we sift it through several levels.
Right.
And by doing that, I think it makes for a better list, because what we're saying is any one of us, if I just say, okay, I'm going to rank all 30, you know, in every organization.
Right.
I'm going to have some guys that I'm wrong on.
I don't think there's a wrong. I think wrong is the wrong answer.
That I'm going to be
– you're higher on
– higher or low on. And the reality of this is that not only – no, not – but when I say wrong, I'll be higher or low on some guys because you know what? But I'll say wrong because if I did that and then ran it by you, Jim, Will, and everyone else, I would be convinced on some players, you know what? I was high on that guy. Then I was wrong.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Like I was on Kyle Martin a couple years ago in your list, apparently. But who knows, actually, who was right or
wrong. He retired, so who knows? But, you know, I mean, but what I'm saying, though, is that, like, and I've said to Jim, like, I've turned in my Reds list, and we started talking about a couple of guys, and I'm like, you know what? Yeah, I see the logic of that. That probably makes more sense.
Like when Jim was talking last year, you feel like in retrospect that Kyle Lotzkar was too not the right guy to be number 10.
He should not have been number 10. But at the same time, and I try to do the same thing and you try to do the same thing, like Jim and I were talking about Tony Zitch in the Cubs list.
Right.
You know, he'll be in the top 30. I'll give you that. He'll be in the top 30.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know what his final resting place is in that list.
It's not set yet.
Because he kept – well, I think it is, but he's a guy that me and Jim kept debating all week.
But we also, though, by you bring someone else's perspective in, you try to refine this list. Because like he said, okay, here's where I had Zitch, and here's what I think about him. And so I threw out the question of, okay – so compare that guy to a guy in my list, Brad Boxberger.
Yep.
Now,
good comp.
And the question is okay, do you think this guy's got a higher ceiling than Boxberger? If you do, why? And is it only because Boxberger has now reached AAA?
Right, and we know more about him.
And we know more about him compared to this guy who hasn't thrown a pro pitch yet.
And that's one thing that we're debating and we're using internally here, and I think we don't even know if we're going to put it in the book, JJ, but we're toying around with an internal rating system to try to make these actually – that would actually bring more consistency across all of our top 30s. And it actually also – the other thing that this would do – and I'm just hinting at it. You can buy the book and see if it's in there or not. One thing it would do – is it would stop people basically from putting a gut feel guy at 10. Because if that guy's basically this grade does not fit at 10, you can't have guys with a lower grade below him.
But this is why I also hope –
I think it's going to be in the book. I'm excited
the other
about
reason
it,
that the other thing that would be key about this is that we'll be honest. We have the organization talent rankings at the front. But we have not had an easy way to look at it.
That has been hectic.
And to say, okay, how does this organization's top 30 really compare to this one? You can kind of do it yourself if you wanted to when you had the book, which we're reading it at home.
And that's what we do. Basically, that has been done by me, Will, and Jim. When the book is done, the last day of the book, one of the last things we do is we each take an hour, go through all the organizations, rank them, put them in a spreadsheet, debate our order.
This is hopefully going to be a little bit more front end of that.
I agree.
But also what it will allow you to do is, if it works out as we hope, you may be able to look and say, hey, the number 20 guy in this organization would be the number five guy in this organization.
Correct.
And that's something we want to do.
We've done that on a gut feel basis, on a snapshot basis, but now we're going to have it
we've talked about it. I mean, the reality of it is like we've talked about it in the past.
I'm very excited about it.
So, like last year, the Royals were number one, the Astros were number 30. And I do remember we talked about it. Okay, so.
That's right.
So where does the Royals' number three prospect slot in on the Astros' number three prospect slot in the Royals list? And it's like,
well, let's talk about that this year, JJ. If you go to the National League Central, where would Jonathan Singleton rank on your Royals' top 10?
He'd be in top five.
I don't think he'd be number one? I would take him over Mike Montgomery. I don't know who your number one is. He's right there for me with Will Myers.
What about Bubba Starling?
That's a good question.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. I haven't sat down and really, but I would say, I mean, I don't think we're giving
away
the story.
Singleton.
We're not.
He's the best first baseman in the minor leagues. I would take him over even Yonder Alonso. If I needed a first baseman in the major leagues in 2012, like the Astros kind of might, if they don't want to play Carlos Lee at first base, if they want to stick him in left field again.
I think they
want to play Carlos Lee at first base. They can't get anyone to take his contract, so I think they would rather have Jonathan Singleton right now. Now, if someone wanted to take Carlos Lee, or if they were in the American League in 2012 and they could play Carlos Lee at DH, they'd rather have Yonder.
I will point out with this, it is true. He's in that discussion for the best first baseman in the minors. What also stands out is how few first base prospects are in the minors right now.
That's another part of that.
Right. I was going to say, because if you rewound this 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, after that 2008 draft, yes, he doesn't fit in. He's not quite as elite instantly. So those are a lot of college bats that were perceived.
But also you have guys like Hosmer. You had guys like if you compare.
Well, he's 2008 draft.
No, but yeah, but like if you compare to me Hosmer and Singleton, I'd rather have Hosmer.
Correct.
If you compare to me, the reality is most of those first basemen from that 08 draft, there are a lot of those guys who.
But Ike Davis has been a good big leaguer already,
right.
Better than people expected. Justin Smoke has been a disappointment.
I'd rather have Singleton. Smoke.
Alan Dykstra's terrible.
I would rather have Singleton.
He was a terrible pick at the
time. Yonder Alonso's still waiting to get a big league
still
shot.
Gaining acceptance. David Cooper.
I'd rather have Jonathan Singleton.
And there's one other first.
I was going to say that 08 draft. The point I was making is that there were some really good first base prospects. A lot of them have not come from that first round, the 08 college group, because a lot of those guys have failed.
Paul Goldschmidt. He wasn't that 08 draft. I don't think. I think he was 09, but.
Would you rather have Paul Goldschmidt or Jonathan Singleton?
Long term, I think Jonathan Singleton had a better career. I really do. Although I like Paul Goldschmidt. Not as much as Ben Badler, but I like Paul Goldschmidt.
I think that is true. Like I think that the Astros, we'll jump in on the Astros here.
Prospect would you rather have as your top pitching prospect, Jared Kozar or Mike Montgomery?
Mike Montgomery.
That's a tough one. I think I'd rather have Mike Montgomery too. That's tough.
I'll put it this way. What would be – I don't think it's actually that tough. What would be the argument?
Jared Kozar has much bigger stuff, and he's not.
No, he's right. He's right-handed. Montgomery is up to 96 from the left side with plus pitches.
You know, I like Mike Montgomery.
But
guy's got a 70 fastball. Mike Montgomery does not pitch with a 70 fastball.
He does pitch with a 70 fastball a lot of times. I've seen it myself.
Yeah, but I don't.
I had two scouts that night tell me this is a 70 fastball.
That was an A-ball 2 years ago.
That A-ball was much better than Jared Kozar had an A-ball, high A-ball this year
it
in
was.
An easier league to pitch.
It was. Maybe I'm starting to lose my – maybe I have prospect fatigue on Mike Montgomery. I do like Mike Montgomery. I think Jared Kozar has bigger stuff. I really do.
But my thing, though, is that Montgomery, I do think the shine you lose it because he's gone. He had a –
My point is when you see Jared – when people see Jared Kozar pitch – he has wow factor that Montgomery does not have.
And you
it's
also
sixes
but those
for Montgomery,
same people,
it's seven for Kozar.
But the same people,
that's
a lot of the same people say there's no way this guy can be a starter.
I haven't run into anybody who says no way.
But there's,
I really
haven't. Think there's a pretty good chance he's going to be a reliever because his delivery. And the other
I think that's the easiest thing for a scout to say about a pitcher. That's a CYA thing for a scout to say.
And the other question with Kozar, though, is that, which is a good question, is, for as good as his stuff is, why does he not miss more bats?
That is a much more legitimate question to me. Because
he does not miss a lot of bats.
He hasn't. He definitely hasn't. That is a very legitimate point. I think the other stuff about him being a reliever, to me, I wouldn't say it's garbage. I think it's CYA. I really do. To me, Jared Kozar is a lot more raw because he was a two-way guy in high school, and he hasn't focused on pitching, and he's a one-less year of pitching experience than Montgomery has as a pro. I think he's a lot further away from his ceiling, not just because it's A ball versus triple A. I think he's a lot more raw. So that's why I think people chalking him up as a relief pitcher already is kind of a joke.
But I
would agree with you. I think Kozar's stuff is bigger. I think it's undeniably bigger stuff than Montgomery. I think Montgomery would probably get the edge for most organizations because he's left-handed, closer to the majors, and still has pretty big stuff.
And he's got a better frame, too.
Yeah, he's a lot taller.
He's a downhill.
Absolutely.
You get that downhill plane that you
this
don't.
This guy's, 6'2", 6'3", but when this guy talked to an instructional,
he's
a
little guy.
That's right, because he's such a small frame. Absolutely. That said, he did throw, 144 innings this year?
He threw 140 innings this year. The concern is that they were not particularly 140 particularly effective innings. On his, admittedly, great Clearwater team. No doubt about that.
Yeah, he was the third best guy in terms of performance.
Yeah, third or fourth.
Yeah, I mean,
Julio
Rodriguez had the best performance. Then I would say probably Pettibone.
And Trevor May was better, too. Trevor May
He struck out a lot of guys, but, he walked a lot more guys, too.
Right.
There's a lot of – he's very similar to Trevor May.
Right.
And, again, while he's a Texas guy and Trevor May's from the Pacific Northwest and has a bigger body, Jared Kozar can sweat properly. He didn't have a problem with sweat like Trevor May did, A. And, B, frankly, he throws more strikes. That's a tough call. Who would I rather have, Trevor May or Jared Kozar? I give a slight edge to Jared Cozart.
I'm going
to
go Mets.
For me. All right. But I like the Astros top seven prospects.
The other notable part of that 10. Is the Astros top seven prospects, I feel compelled to note, are the seven guys that they've brought in trades.
No, six.
Six. George Springer. George Springer and six guys they brought in trades.
Correct. And I think the important part, I actually just wrote my column about this. I think before we judge the Astros scouting department and player development
harshly
for the fact that six of their top seven guys are trade pieces, as even Richard Justice did, the columnist for the Houston Chronicle, and that was his, he saw the top 10 and just said, indictment of Bobby Heck. And I think Richard's wrong, and the reason that he's wrong is I think you have to acknowledge how deep the hole was. You know, if anybody
it's an indictment of it. It doesn't know, but the question is who do you point the fingers at? Because it's an indictment of their farm system and all.
The first finger that gets pointed is at Tal Smith. Number one, because I'm a Carolina guy and he went to Duke.
He kids.
Sorry. Number two, I do kid. I really do hate Duke. Number two, in spite of the fact that I love Danny Otero, my favorite 40-man ad who went to Duke. Number two reason is that Tal Smith has been there forever. Tal Smith has been in the Astros system forever, and they've had bad drafts for 10 years. And to me, that had just been a message from on high that the draft doesn't matter. Since Lance Berkman, JJ, drafted in 1997, and then they also in 97 brought in to their organization Roy Oswalt, 96 draft and follow. So since 97, they've brought in three regulars of any note. I'm not giving my main man, Jason Lane, credit as a regular of note. He had one good year as a big league regular. Morgan Ensberg, who had a very short career and is already a overwrought broadcaster. Ben Zobrist, who was an accidental six-round pick. And Hunter Pence. That's it. That is it. They haven't drafted well for a long time. That's David Lakey, Paul Ricciarini, and Bobby Heck as scouting directors. That's a whole lot of area scouts, cross-checkers. There's so much turnover, I'm sure. And player development, farm directors, coordinators. It's been a collective fail on the part of the Astros in scouting and player development for more than a decade, with very few exceptions. And to me, that comes from on high, from Drayton McClain, Tal Smith, the people who are in charge of the organization, of what direction the organization is going to go in. They've chosen to spend money only one place. That's on the Major League roster. They haven't chosen to spend in the draft, and it really went downhill when they didn't go over slot for Drew Stubbs out of high school, let him go to the University of Texas.
The reality is, as bad as Drew Stubbs had a bad year this year, he'd
be their best draft pick since, other than Hunter Pence and Ben Zobrist, in the last since Lance Berkman. And there's no question. So they.
Derek Dietrich, who they also did not would be one of the.
He'd be in this top 10. I wouldn't put him over Telvin Nash. I'd take Telvin Nash over him. He's not a shortstop. I like Derek Dietrich. He's probably a utility guy. So I like Dietrich. Brett Eibner, high ceiling, but you don't know how their career would go differently. But
right.
I think you have to understand just how deep the hole was the Astros were in. I think there are things that Bobby Heck and his group could have done better. Specifically, I think that the college players the Astros have drafted haven't been great college draft picks, especially college pitchers.
Their
hole was the Marianas Trench. It was really, really deep.
The point you're making, and we went back and looked at a couple of years. Like you look at like their 2009 minor league clubs. There were teams that did not have anyone on them.
Oh yeah, that made the major leagues.
And
put it this way, JJ, they've had two winning full season teams out of their last 5 years. You go back 2007 through 2011, 5 years. Four minor league full season teams every year. Two of them have had a winning record. One of them was 71-68. They have no talent. They've had no talent.
And the thing,
when Bobby
Heck
came in, they had no talent.
The point with that is that when you do have no talent, when you have no talent, that also hurts development of when you bring in a prospect.
That's correct.
Because for one, he doesn't have anyone. You generally don't have someone to model yourself after.
Correct.
For two, you generally have to get pushed levels above where you should be because, we don't have anyone to play that position.
Hey, we know we were low. I was low on Jose Altuve last year. Jose Altuve still shouldn't have been in the major leagues. He should not have been in the major leagues this year. In a good organization, he's not. You don't have a guy who goes from instructs to the big leagues in 1 year. I don't care how good his first half is or was in the minor leagues. Same with Jimmy Paredes. Same with J.D. Martinez, to a lesser degree, although at least J.D. Martinez, I think we know what he is. He's going to be a solid average, maybe above average hitter, and a below average athlete slash defender. That's kind of who he is. Maybe he's Carlos Lee 2.0.
So
the Astros' lack of talent and the hole they were in meant that Delino DeShields had to be in full season ball all year, and he shouldn't have been. Mike Fultonavich was in full season ball all year, and he shouldn't have been. And that affects development of guys like Tanner Bouchou, who was in full season ball in 2010, survived, but shouldn't have been there. And then I think it's the word I have in the organization is he was exhausted last offseason, didn't come to camp in as strong or as in shape as he should have. Maybe if he played a half season, maybe if he'd been in Tri-City in 2010, he would have been in shape physically to go 2011. So it's a cumulative effect. And the Reds, the organization you do a top 10 for, it's kind of the opposite of that, JJ, and that they've had pretty nice depth. And now, I guess they have the opposite problem. Is there any, you think there's some stagnation setting in with some of these prospects? Have any of these guys gone backwards being in AAA for a second year?
At best, I think you could argue that several of them have basically not improved because of it. I mean, I don't know that you can say that really – did Zach Cozart gain anything by another 300 at-bats in AAA this year? He had hit 20 home runs, I believe, the year before, if I remember correctly, in AAA.
Yeah, something like that.
You know, so I'm not saying there weren't some –
he had a good AAA the year
before. I'm not saying that there were not some things. I'm sure that he added some polish and all, but the reality of it is that, no, he probably did not need that. They have a whole lot of guys in their top 10 who I've been writing about now, it seems like.
Which Cozart would rather have, Jared or Zach?
Jared.
Yeah,
probably.
Long term.
But if I need a shortstop for this year, you know, I need Zach. But, there are things that jump out with the Reds that they're very consistent about. One is, you know, there's always going to be some shortstops in their top 10.
That's right.
They,
from the man who brought you the farm system with Michael Young and Orlando Hudson and all the middle infielders, the story we both heard from scouting director Chris Buckley for more than a decade now.
But so if you look at this top 10, Billy Hamilton, Zach Cozart, Didi Gregorius.
Yeah.
That's three shortstops, and those are three shortstops there.
Three
very different shortstops. Maybe not all of them end up being a shortstop, and Billy Hamilton's the biggest question on that. But those are all middle of the diamond type players who are going to play short, second, or in Hamilton's case, you know, there are some scouts who think that, you know, hey, just put him in center field and let him be a gold glover and steal 100 bases and do all that. The other thing they're going to have, the Reds.
It's so awesome to look down at his stat line and see 103. I'm sorry, that's just awesome.
The other thing for the Reds, though, is that they are a team that does not draft, say, oh, we took a guy in this or we've got this guy, so we're not going to take this guy.
Right.
And that's so
they go by their board.
They make their board
and they draft their board.
And the thing that there's here's the advantages of that. If you look at their top picks year by year, Homer Bailey, Jay Bruce, Drew Stubbs, Devin Mesoraco, Yonder Alonso, Mike Leake, Yasmani Grandal, Robert Stevenson. Robert Stevenson, we haven't seen anything yet. We can't make any judgment on him. From 2004 on, I don't think you can say another one of those guys has not worked out.
Like, yeah, Homer's the one guy who...
Right. Homer has not reached the eight potential that he should have, that everyone expected him to reach.
Yeah.
At the same time...
He's had some success.
He is a back end of the rotation starter now for essentially 3 years.
Yeah.
And he'll be a back end of the rotation starter at least for probably another five, you know.
Yeah, he's got 430
big league innings.
That's not a bust story, I would say. It's not a bust. I agree.
Right. The thing that jumps out with that, though, is that now, but so what you get with that, though, is Yonder Alonso is a first baseman. Yonder Alonso can't play first base as long as Joey Votto's there.
That's right.
Yasmani Grandal is a catcher. Maybe he can play a little third or whatever, but he's a catcher. That's his value. Devin Mesoraco may close that door before Yasmani Grandal gets to the big leagues, or they may, a year from now, say, hey, Devin Mesoraco, set aside, we're going to put Yasmani Grandal there.
Right.
They have a decision to make there. If Zach Cozart steps in as expected and plays shortstop this year and plays well, a year from now, Didi Gregorius is probably going to be ready to play at the big league level. Well, probably he's going to be on that Cozart plan where it's
That's
like,
right.
You know what? Get 700, 800 at-bats at AAA, then let's talk.
I'm not even sure if that's a Dusty Baker thing. It's really just the Reds thing right now.
And then Todd Frazier, when Todd Frazier was drafted, one of the selling points of him is that he was a pretty polished guy who you thought
right.
could move pretty quickly. Well, he was drafted in 07.
He's going to be 26 next year.
He's going to be 26 this year. And the reality of it is that there's no spot for Todd Frazier to play every day, probably.
Yeah, except for shortstop. He wants a shot at that shortstop job.
I don't think that's
happening. That would be awesome. It would just be awesome.
Don't think that's happening. And so that's the thing that jumps out with the Reds is that there is a lot of depth here. Ideally, of their top 10 prospects here, 5 of them could lose rookie eligibility this year.
I'll tell you what, who my cheese ball is in that list is D.D. Gregorius.
I like
D.D. Gregorius. He seems like a shortstop with a little juice and ability.
And whose best days are probably still ahead of him. I mean,
again,
relatively polished, but we are talking about he was 21 all year. Double A for the second half of the season, 21-year-old.
What was his injury this year? Why did he miss a little time?
It was spring training. What was it? He had a minor, I think it was intestinal issue, if I remember correctly, in spring training. It was something.
Indigestion.
There was something that held him back a little bit. I'm just not remembering off the top of my head right now.
Put you on the spot.
But there's
he's got some tools.
He's a guy. This is another thing, how we put together our list. I liked him. He moved up on this list once I started talking to people outside of that organization. Because inside the organization, when people say they like someone, you expect that. You know?
That's right.
If you don't like any of your prospects, well, then you're probably in the wrong field of business.
You really shouldn't be talking to us. You need to figure out that you can, try to massage that system a little bit,
But
talk up your prospects to us.
But when we talk to – because we cross-check all these lists with people outside the organizations. And when you'd have – guy would, you talk to guys and they'd say, that Gregorius, I really like Gregorius. That's when it kind of jumps out like, hey, and then you kind of step back and go, well, let's look at him. 21-year-old, played shortstop at AA, good defensively, got a really good arm, athleticism. Yeah, I could see that being, a guy who's a top 10 prospect.
Don't forget starting shortstop for your World Cup gold medalists with the Netherlands. Tim Stoofbergen swears by D.D. Gregorius. Actually, I don't think I even asked I don't even think I asked him about D.D. Gregorius, but...
By the way, played shortstop on a team that also had... and they had Charlon Schoop and...
Jonathan Schoop.
Jonathan Schoop.
Charlon played a lot of first base in that event. Also, they had Xander Bogaerts.
The thing is, we said it before it started, infield in the World Cup was on the Netherlands.
We said they might have the best roster. In terms of prospects and like talent, we said they might have the best roster. Now, they didn't win the World Cup because of Xander Bogaerts. Jonathan Schoop was important. And so was D.D. Gregorius. He was second on their team in walks. They mainly won because of Stoofbergen, Rob Cordovans, and Kurt Smith.
Okay,
and
we got to get back on track. Okay, Cup system.
Speaking of the World Cup, Team USA center fielder Brett Jackson.
Number one.
Was number one on our Cubs list. The quick thing on the Cubs is, to me, I look at these mugshots. I'm off Dan Vogelbach. I love Dan Vogelbach. I respect Dan Vogelbach, a high school kid who's listed already at 255. He's going to have to be Prince Fielder for me to think this guy's going to be an impact big leaguer. I was a little stunned that Jim put Vogelbaum at number 10. And the Cubs list is not the greatest top 10 in the world. It's not the worst one in this division, but it's close.
To me?
It's closer to the worst one than it is to the best one.
There are a lot of guys in the second half of this top 10 who don't look like top 10 guys to me.
Yeah, Josh Vitters, Rafael Dolis, and Junior Lake are all guys with pretty big holes in their games.
Right.
Josh Vitters, I think, still has a pretty high upside, but, because he does have bat-to-ball skills, but they're too much for his own good.
Right, it is. It's one of those things where it's like,
his name was Josh Gonzalez, and he was a Latin American signee with that, and not the number 3 overall pick with his track record,
I don't think he'd
be in the top 10. Let's be honest.
No, I think that's... So there's a lot of guys on this list who, there's a lot of guys who I go, I don't know. The Cubs have a whole lot of guys playing the same positions on the same team.
Yeah, it's a big problem, I think.
And a lot of them playing positions that they don't profile for.
I've not been a big fan of their player development approach for a long time, and that's an example of it.
I don't understand why
you do that. Why do you play Josh Vitters and all these other third basemen on
the
same team?
DJ LeMahieu, Ryan Flaherty, all three of those guys played third base at some point on the same team. It wasn't something where they said, okay, LeMahieu, you're playing this. Flaherty, you're playing this. They did. Flaherty and LeMahieu did that the year before in the Florida State League, too. Okay, today, Flaherty, you're a second baseman.
Right.
Today, LeMahieu, you're a third baseman. Tomorrow, you're Flaherty, you're a third baseman. LeMahieu, you're a second baseman. The thing I don't understand, well, especially the thing I don't understand with that is that what ends up happening is that you have these guys who...
Don't forget, Junior Lake was on that team, too, and his best position probably is not shortstop. It's probably third base.
Right. But he was a short, you know.
But I
understand more of telling a guy, for now, you're a shortstop. Play yourself, you know, we're going to let you stay on it, or you're going to play yourself off.
That makes a little more sense.
That makes logical sense to me. But, and the real problem with that, though, is that with LeMahieu, like, I don't think LeMahieu profiles at third base.
No. I don't think he profiles anywhere. He's an extra guy. You know, they really believe in the bat.
But
sure,
but especially
if you want a singles hitter, great.
But to me, with that, he is the guy. Like, okay, put Flaherty again, and I'm not. Hey, they know more about their guys than we do.
Certainly hope so.
But that being said, Flaherty, if everything works right, Flaherty could profile third base. Probably not,
right?
But he could.
He could. If everything comes together, Ryan Flaherty is a left-handed hitting Mark DeRosa.
Whereas LeMahieu, if he can play second, could profile at second base.
Right. Yes. Even though, with today's game, where I think power is out of the game a little bit, yeah.
High average, you know.
DJ LeMahieu is like a dead ball era third baseman. That's what he should be. He should have been a singles hitting, like a, you know, a pie trainer.
Well, I think what the Cubs hope, what the Cubs hope is that they got Jeff Cirillo there. But the thing about it is
they did.
Huh?
They didn't. Yeah, you're right. That's what they think, but they didn't.
Right, but I think that's what they're hoping
is
that
that's a good comp.
Is that that's production-wise what he could be.
That's a good.
But the problem with that, though,
there.
Is a couple things. One is that Cirillo was really good defensively for
he
one.
He was.
And for another is that, I mean, there aren't – Jeff Cirillo, what stands out about him is he doesn't fit a profile because he's kind of one of those unique players.
Right, and I don't mean to hate on DJ LeMahieu, but – I just don't see him or Junior Lake as future regulars, and I saw Junior
Lake
in the fall.
Lake could be a future regular, or you know, could coming out of the eighth inning, ninth inning.
I think that is kind of silly. At this point that he's a pitcher.
No, I'm joking somewhat, but the reality of it is
a lot of people aren't. A lot of people think he should be a pitcher, and by this point,
he has an
ADR. He actually does not. People keep saying that. Look at it. I watched that fall league game. It was ugly. His arm was ugly.
All I know is in the Florida State League, I was getting that, that's an 80.
I would love to see that 80 arm because I was saying that beforehand, too. And, you know, his manager, Stu Cole, at the Rising Stars game, that's playing against him in the Fall League. I think he manages him in the Fall League, I should say. Compton to Troy Tulowitzki. That was crazy. The fact that Stu Cole wears Colorado Rockies gear and gets his paycheck, it says Dan O'Dowd on it, or somebody, or Charles Montford signs his check, and he comped Junior Lake. Tulowitzki is crazy. Then watching that game, I know it's one look, but even watching infield, JJ, I did not see that arm strength. It was in all my scouting reports. I wrote for MLB Network. One of the best arms in the minor leagues, if not the best arm in the minor leagues. He was either gassed or holding back, and he certainly did not look like he had shortstop actions. Who he reminds me of just watching that game is Tim Beckham. He's very similar to Tim Beckham, and I take Tim Beckham. Even though Junior Lake runs better, I'd take Tim Beckham. Neither one of them is a big league shortstop.
Right. And that's the thing is it's like
I would take
that's
Beckham
the thing it's like we're not scouts, but at the same time it's funny but we talked about like we went to an Appy League game together and it's something that you can when you see it there is something that stands out. Like
Nico Goodrum, I'd take him and be a future shortstop over these two guys.
Right. You're like you look at it and it's like that is shortstop action.
That's what we want. That's infield actions.
That's
exactly
it's not
right.
Part one, part two, part three. It is. There is no part where you can stop it and say that this is where he went from this to this. It's a fluid.
Yeah, boy, we really liked Nico Goodrum.
Yeah, we did.
He was really fun to watch take infield. It's the Baseball America podcast with John and JJ rifling through the National League Central. We've done the first three in alphabetical order. JJ, I was actually emailing with a scout this morning about the Brewers. I think we wrote that the Brewers are much improved in their farm system, and yet maybe we ranked them 30th last year. They would dispute that they were 30.
Let's make clear. No one ever goes, yeah, we were 30.
That's right. Usually people don't own it. they're not going to be 30
this year.
The Astros
were 30, and I don't think they would have said, yeah, we're 30, even though they were a good 30.
I think they had a good year in their farm system this year, and it's still not a good farm system. I still think it's the weakest top 10 in the division.
Yeah, I mean,
I like Willie Peralta, but he's not really a classic number one prospect.
But he's not the guy that jumps out to me where I go, I think about number five is where this list starts to go, okay, that's not. Because you do that test of, okay, does this guy seem like a top 10 prospect? Scooter Gennett has hit. Let's make that clear.
He had a really nice fall
league. Had a really good fall league,
second
too.
Second in the fall league in batting.
He had a really good fall league.
Good for league. Him. If you're going to go to the fall league, stand out a little bit. If you're going to hit where the offense is good, hit 400 like Scooter Gennett did.
At the same time, Scooter Gennett's ceiling is pretty low.
Yes.
You know.
There hasn't really ever been a superstar in any sport named Scooter.
But Logan Schaefer, Cody Scarpetta, Taylor Green.
Good role players.
Right. I was going to say, which of those guys do you pick out and say that guy could be an impact regular?
None. I think Logan Schaefer will be a nice, you know, if everything comes together, Logan Schaefer could have a Mark Kotze kind of career.
And that's aiming everything.
High. That's aiming a little high.
That's everything came together.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have Mark Kotze's power. So early career Mark Kotze power.
He don't have Mark Kotze's two-way ability either.
No, I don't think he can pitch. I really, Jim Callis would strike me down for comparing him to Mark Kotze, his favorite college baseball player ever. Taylor Green, not really a classic profile guy. He's a left-handed hitting infielder. You know, he could be the regular third baseman the next 2 years going forward. You know, I think they wish that were Brett Lowry, but that ship has sailed. But yeah, I agree. I love Jimmy Nelson coming out of college. It's a pretty uninspiring year for a guy coming out of the Southeastern Conference to go to the Midwest League, a pitcher's league, and post a 4.30 ERA, and he still makes the top 10. It's an uninspiring
year. And also, admittedly, he throws hard, some command issues, but 65 walks, 146 innings isn't something that you look for from, again, a college guy pitching against younger hitters.
I think it's very possible that Tyler Thornburg, the number four prospect, is a reliever. But I think he could be an impact reliever. I do like their top three guys. Peralta's had success at AA and AAA. Taylor Youngman and Jed Bradley are both good, solid college pitchers that they drafted.
And the thing about it, though, is that, look, and we've said this last year at the Brewers, they were 30. We understand there's different ways.
They won
96 games because, in some ways, but they were 30. They gutted the farm system intentionally.
Right.
They traded away their best prospects and their best young big leaguer who they just had come up, who was basically in his first year.
Right.
They traded those guys away. If you took this team and said, okay, add in Jake Odorizzi.
Hey, you took their farm system, that's right.
Brett Lowry.
Right.
Add in, I know he doesn't qualify, but add in Lorenzo Cain. Add in Jeremy Jeffress.
Right.
I know he doesn't qualify, but add in Alcides Escobar.
Right.
It's a different system.
Absolutely. They look a lot better. And if you add in a better draft system where you don't have to wait till the middle of August
and
to
add
get
in
Dylan Covey. His physical, so you could maybe, really the best part of a draft would be have the draft at the end of June, and in the middle of June you have a Major League Baseball draft combine, and everybody comes in and at least has a medical combine. And you say, oh, Dylan Covey, it helps Dylan Covey too. By the way, you have type 1 juvenile diabetes. You need to get this taken care of. You know, that, again, that was part of the reason why the Brewers were 30 last year, and that was not their fault. So
that was the fault of the system. Hey, you can't talk to them until the day before the deadline.
Yep.
Oh, well, now we don't have time. Dylan Covey didn't have time to process it.
Terrible. So and this year they get Jed Bradley out of it, and you know what? Jed Bradley's probably going to wind up being better than Dylan Covey anyway, so they had to suffer being the number 30 organization for a year, but I do think they're rebounding as an organization. Pittsburgh Pirates, JJ, still working their way back. They're clearly investing a lot of money in the draft. I really like their top five, six guys. I'm a Kyle MacPherson fan. I think he's a nice deep sleeper. Had a great breakthrough year this year.
Kyle MacPherson is impressive because that is a development
success story. Yeah.
That is a development success story where a guy who you can say, no, you know what? That guy is significantly better than when they in the 14th round.
That's
when
right.
They drafted him.
That's a great
and
find.
That's credit. You got to give credit. You know, those are the things that stand out. Like, because that's not you took a guy 1-1 or you took a guy 1-3.
Yeah, that's not $13 million on two amateurs in Josh Bell and Garrett Cole. Absolutely. This is a guy from a Division II school, Mobile, University of Mobile. which is not a noted prospect hotbed. I really like that. I like that development story, and I like Kyle McPherson as a prospect. To me, the second half of the top 10 is not as good. Although Robbie Grossman, you could do worse for a number 8 prospect than a switch hitting. Might be a tweener, might be Rusty Greer part 2.
Right. Robbie Grossman is the kind of guy who you doubt him.
Yeah.
Some of those guys you turn around and at least have a couple of years where you go, that was pretty good.
I think he'll be a solid regular
right.
if it all
like,
pans out.
Like, if it all pans out. And the thing that they're going to have for them is, well, he's a tweener. We know this much. If he stays with the Pirates, he'll be playing a corner.
Yeah, he'll be a right fielder for the Pirates because left field's big there, and they're going to probably have speedier guys.
Well,
and I guess they
could
move
McCutcheon
to right
and they got
field.
Marte.
To me, it would make more sense when Marte gets there that you have Marte, who apparently is just a super stud in center field, Marte in center, and McCutcheon, to me, should go to left because that's the bigger park in their home field, so you play
and
the
then
big
what
field.
You end up having is okay,
Grossman
probably
right.
arrives right at the time that Jose Tabata becomes too expensive to be worth having if you even think he's going to be around
probably,
that long.
That was probably this year.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
that, you know. But
I'm not sure what happened to Jose Tabata, but he's an unusual dude. No matter what his
but
contract
the
is.
But the problem for Grossman is that you better hurry up, though, because Josh Bell is coming up behind him.
That's the problem. He's a placeholder, I think, for Josh Bell. I like Jeff Locke as a fourth, fifth starter type. Stetson Alley, I'm afraid of based on his mugshot. He looks like he's going to kill somebody in that mugshot. I mean, I kid. He just looks like he's fixing. He looks like he's spoiling for a fight. That's what I should say in that mugshot. Which is the worst mugshot, Stetson Alley or Dan Vogelbach?
Dan Vogelbach from the standpoint of...
I agree. When the scouting report says we want him down to 240. Yeah. That's just... And you know what? Dan Vogelbach could do it. The guy can really hit. His track record of hitting is pretty outstanding, but yeah, that's the worst
mugshot. The thing that I'll say this, here's where I think the Pirates have come to. Let's be honest. Rewind this several years, Luis Urrutia is number 1 on their list.
Yeah, well, or Marte, like the double A.
No, I'm
outfielder.
Saying, but Luis Heredia, though, is the guy who feels like that. A couple of years ago, that was the guy who would be the Pirates' number 1. Is the guy who's
their
the
internal number 1? You mean?
No, I'm saying that we would end up ranking like the farm system is such that the guy who Luis Heredia is a great number 5.
Yeah, he is. He's a good. Really,
he's a bad number 1 because what I'm saying is that it's that guy who is so far away that. Yes, if everything comes together, he is a front-end ace. But you know what? He's also thrown 30 innings in the GCL.
I forgot, by the way, that Jose Tabata's contract is a 6-year deal. He signed through 2016. Man, that's a lot of love for Jose Tabata.
And now we round out with the Cardinals.
But you're right on Heredia. Heredia is in a good spot. It's a sign of an improving farm system. An improving farm system would be the Cardinals. It's a nice position to be in, JJ, when you've just won your World Series championship.
I like
and
this
your farm system
a lot.
Is really coming forward. This is probably the best top 10 in the division.
Yeah, I would.
I think it is.
Pirates, if you want to say that the Pirates' top 5 is better than the Cardinals' top 5, it's a good argument. I may take the Cardinals, but it's a good argument. You can argue it either way. I don't think, though, when you say Tyrell Jenkins number 6.
Yeah, that's a good
Tyrell Jenkins number 6 and Luis Heredia number 5.
I take Tyrell Jenkins.
There's, you know.
Tyrell Jenkins sounds pretty exciting. Nothing against Luis Heredia. Tyrell Jenkins sounds pretty exciting. He sounds like an electric, physical athlete who could be a front-of-the-rotation guy. They have 3 front-of-the-rotation arms in their top 6 in Shelby Miller, Carlos Martinez, and Tyrell Jenkins.
And
you've got a couple of guys who've already helped your big league team in Lance Lynn and Eduardo Sanchez.
And they've got a couple guys in that top 6. Look, I'm not a giant Zach Cox fan, but I'll admit, they have 2 guys there who, if everything broke right, either one of them could challenge for a batting title.
Yeah, that's possible. Colton Wong especially. I think that's especially true.
Oh, I'm
Colton
not going
Wong.
Colton Wong.
And Oscar Tavares.
No, I was going to say, I'll give you Zach Cox credit.
I think Colton Wong will do it more than Zach Cox. I think Zach Cox could be a 25 home run guy. I think that's where – I think he's like a – he could be.
But,
if it all comes together, he's like a 270,
but when you say that, though,
home run
but the
guy.
Thing about it is I don't think Zach Cox, though. Zach Cox, he had that swing, and he's tried to go to a new swing.
Yeah, you know, to me, I think that Zach Cox, when it's all said and done,
goes
he
back
has
to
hit
his...
No, I think he has hit ability, but he doesn't run. And to me, when it's all said and done, he's going to wind up being a corner power bat, not a pure hit guy. I just don't think – I think when it's – I think he has – hitting ability and hand-eye and all that kind of stuff, I think when it's all said and done, the power is going to be the carrying tool for him.
But
I think the
hit
tool will be the carrying tool for him.
I will say this. It's a much, much, much lower chance of it happening. Their number 9 prospect, though, if everything came together, could win a batting title, too.
Oh, Matt Adams can win a batting title?
It's not going to happen. Let's just make clear. But it's funny, when I was doing a story on Oscar Tavares.
Early, we like Oscar Tavares.
I like Oscar Tavares a lot. But when I was doing a story on him, talking to his manager there, Gian Rodriguez,
mm-hmm.
and he made the point. He said, it's a great hit tool. I mean, he can put the barrel in the ball. The only guy in the organization I think who fits there with them is Patch Adams. And it's like,
interesting.
And it's like, wow.
First of all, he goes by the nickname Patch. I mean, that was a horrible movie. How'd that happen?
I don't know, but Matt Adams is a limited player. Again, we're talking minuscule chance.
Yeah, no, I got
you. But the thing that he has is he has the ability to hit.
Yeah, he had a surprising fall league, because he really, for a guy who, I know he doesn't control the strike zone great, but he had a really horrible strikeout to walk in the fall league. I mean, it is what it is. I like the Division II Pennsylvania guys. There are a few of those kicking around. Obviously, a good year for that with Ryan Vogelsong with the Giants.
And again, don't get too excited. I'm not, when I say that, don't get
He's
too excited.
He's a good number 9.
But that is a number 9? Number 9 who hit 300, 357, 566 at AA.
It was his age 22 season. At AA, and he killed it. I mean, he killed it, and that's after skipping level as well. So, that's legit power. There's a legit bat.
He fits
the David Freese, Alan Craig model also for that organization.
I just think that if you look at it, and especially that's things that summed up again, all of this.
Good role
there's
player.
Drafting, but there's also player development, and the Cardinals right now can say, "Hey, we seem to have an idea what we're doing in player development."
I think they do, and I'm a big Brent Strom fan. He's their pitching coordinator. He did a nice job with the Expos before he came to the Cardinals, and right now he's got some real power arms to work with, and Carlos Martinez, Tyrell Jenkins, Shelby Miller all made a lot of progress in 2011. So to me, JJ, the Cardinals are the top farm system in the National League Central.
They're world champs, and I would agree with you on that. I'd probably say Pirates, too, just because of the top-end guys.
I think I would also agree with that.
I would probably say Reds 3 because, again, there's 5 guys in that who could be playing the big leagues this year.
I agree. Cincinnati, to me, is closer to 2 than they are to 4. I think Cincinnati could be 2. They're very different. If you were the Pirates, maybe long-term you'd rather have your farm system, but if they could trade, how many of those guys would the Reds would be in the Pirates opening day lineup in 2012? A lot of them.
Now, here's the question. We're just ranking top 10s right now. When top 30s, it may change.
Well, what if we rank 31 to 50? That's
yeah,
bad.
Cubs? Versus the Astros.
Astros are better.
Yeah, I agree.
They're better.
I agree.
Better top 10.
It's a better top 10. I don't know about the top 30, but I know the top 10. I would agree with him on that. And I think the Cubs are ahead of the Brewers.
Yes, I would agree with that. We're in agreement. That's good. We didn't start off that way in the podcast, but we're finishing that way on this long podcast. Take you through your Thanksgiving drive. Hope the kids enjoyed listening to us in the back seat in the car on the drive to Grandma's house. For JJ Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you on the next Baseball America podcast. Until then, so long, everybody.